I don't believe anything unless I understand it inside out. And even if I understand something, it is not uncommon that I disagree with accepted view, even if it's a Nobel laureate. Michael Burry.
Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
All right, welcome back, my one faithful listener, to another episode of Court is in Session. I need to do these more often, but, you know, time gets ahead of me sometimes. This is a pretty fun episode because we are recording on the placid waters of Lake Seminole on a day that's not too terribly cold after a frigid night, especially by, you know, Florida boy standards. But I'm happy to have a very special guest. Maybe we should call this one the pH level because I have my dad, P.H. Culver. He finally begged me enough to get on the podcast, and I figured he's paid enough of my bills for a long time that I should relent and let him talk for a little bit. So, Dad, thanks for coming on the show.
Well, you're welcome. I think it was cold last night by any level. Just so your listeners know, we camped, six of us, in a pop-up, and the space heater broke, and it was probably 28 when we woke up, which is very cold for Florida, but we are in the northern part of the state. And from where I sit, I will take a takeoff of a quote from Sarah Palin. We can see Georgia from where we are at right now. Even though we're in Florida, we can see across the lake into Georgia on Lake Seminole. So
now, you know, Sarah Palin didn't actually say that.
What, that you can see Georgia from where I'm at?
Well, she never said you can see Alaska from my, or you can see Russia from my house. She wasn't the one that actually said that.
Oh, really?
Tina Fey said that, but she looks and sounds so much like Sarah Palin when she was doing her bit that everybody just assumed it was Sarah Palin. But that was actually Tina Fey. That was on Saturday Night Live.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Well, there you go. My apologies to Sarah Palin, but we can see Georgia from here.
So we can see Georgia from here. Yeah.
Which is kind of cool. I just found out that this is the home of many thousands of migratory fowls here, and we have a fantastic view. Wherever you look, it's just beautiful here. The campground's a little bit coming back from Hurricane Michael, which happened several years ago, kind of destroyed it, but they've rebuilt it. And, of course, to Florida standards, everything looks pretty cool out here. So yeah, it's a nice little place to camp. We were fortunate to get the campsite. It's right lakefront, and here we are.
Florida's a wonderful, wonderful place, and my parents love Florida even more than I do. And my mom especially doesn't get it that I moved up to D.C., and I still don't think I don't think she's forgiven me for not going to UF law. So,
well, I forgive you for not going to UF law, maybe Florida State law, but UF law, I totally get it. No, I think you made the right choice. I think you're doing a lot of fun things, and definitely probably the right call for you. And, you know, we could not be more happy with the position that you're in and what you're doing.
Aww.
So there's enough of that. So I think what we're going to talk about is a interesting time, I think, in the relatively recent past financially for the United States. Am I correct?
I think so. And just by a little bit of way of introduction, you don't have to share your entire balance sheet, but let's go over why you're qualified to talk about this particular era in U.S. financial history. Tell us a little bit about yourself, the industry that you're in, what you do for a living, what you did in 2007.
Okay. So I'll go a little bit. I'll just tell a quick thing. So how many faithful listeners do you have?
You know, I get about 40 listens per episode. I don't know if those are unique listeners per piece, but I assume that most people don't listen to my episodes twice. So,
okay. So I am a realtor by trade. I got my license at age 18 in 1988, so I've been selling real estate for 30 years plus 30 something years. I don't know. It's a long time, but I'm also a real estate investor. I've worked in development as well, but during the financial crash, it happened here in Ocala, and we were the home of Taylor Bean and Whitaker and the infamous Lee Farkas was the head of that. And I knew all of that situation as it unfolded.
And Taylor Bean and Whitaker was the, if I remember correctly, the largest private mortgage origination firm in the country, right?
I believe it was either first or second, but it kind of fell apart for them. Interesting story. I don't think we'll have time to get into that particular portion of it, but it was part of the whole collapse of the real estate and mortgage market back in the 2006, 2008, 2010 era. And it was part of the absolute collapse of that particular portion of our economy. And what I think I want to talk about is, but needless to say, during that time, it was fortunate that I bought some property at pretty low prices, and I've used those as rental properties. That is the part of the reason that I feel qualified to speak on this particular era of our financial past.
All right. So guess broad strokes, what happened in 2007 and what could have been done better from, let's say, well, what could have been done better overall? What are the biggest problems that you saw with how it happened and how it was handled?
A brief synopsis is George W. Bush decided that everybody should be able to own a home, whether you were qualified or not, in my opinion. He said that there was qualifications, but there really weren't. And they kept dropping qualifications. In fact, I had I was involved in development of new homes in Central Florida, and there's several stories that I could tell you that were just outrageous. But one of them was a woman who came and bought a property, and she just had one name. She didn't have a last name, didn't have any kind of Social Security number that I knew of, or had just had no ties to the area, didn't have a job, got 100% loan at a very low interest rate. And it was the third house she had bought. And I don't know how you managed to do that, but I didn't know that people didn't have a last name. It was something new to me. I'd never done that before. And her name, she had a first name, and then the last name was NLN, which stands for no last name. Also had a couple situations where people would buy multiple homes and they really didn't have a job. All this was because that you could state your income, which means you told the mortgage company what your income was. And we used to laugh about it, and we called it BIC income and BIC credit, because you could take your BIC pen and write in those numbers. And there was some of those loan programs that if you paid a little bit more interest rate, you'd be above 100% loan to value from certain situations. But a lot of bad lending practices happened. And that was allowed. They were selling them to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And then they were packaging those loans, they were slicing and dicing them, and they were selling them to all over the country, kind of like as a bond. And so when people all of a sudden, there was a break in the real estate market, and I can tell you when that actually happened, a lot of what was going on was people buying in South Florida and then moving up into Florida and then all across the nation starting from that. And Hurricane Wilma came through and caused a lot of a slowdown. It was a surprise hurricane thing that kind of came through. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back with regards to our market in Central Florida.
So really, it all kind of it all was going smoothly, but the thing that was causing it to go smoothly, and I'm using air quotes here, was that it kept going. And as soon as you had a little bump in the road, that was Hurricane Wilma. That's when it all kind of started crashing down.
Well, it had started weakening before that, but that was like when the faucet turned off because so many deals went dead, at least in our Central Florida market.
Yeah. So all of these, bad loans were being made because it was understood that Fannie and Freddie would buy them, if I understand correctly. That was, why were they rated as good credit? Why were these independent credit agencies coming? Did they have kickbacks from this, or what was their incentive?
I don't know what the kickback was, but the incentive was that you could originate these loans, and there's huge amounts of money made in origination of loans. You have an origination fee. Sometimes you have discount points. You have just the sheer number and volume of them. I mean, there was billions of loans being originated, and the money was just coming hand over fist. And then it kind of dipped down into actually the land prices as well. Land values exploded. People who had never dabbled in real estate all of a sudden were buying up lots and building houses with builders that had just gotten their builders licenses and contractors licenses. And to be honest with you, about 6 months before everything happened, the builder that I was dealing with, we decided to stop building in the market because prices had gone up so much and profit margins were so big. There's a saying out there that pigs get fat and hogs get slaughtered, and we did not want to get slaughtered because you cannot have a situation where excess profits breeds ruinous competition, and you don't want to be stuck in that position. And so we made the conscious decision, even when the profits were the highest, to stop building and take our money and pull it off the table. And none of the investors that I was involved with lost a penny during that. Nobody lost a house. None of them got foreclosed on. Nothing.
So this all came to a head, and people realized that it was kind of built on a house of cards, and there were foreclosures happening, real estate values tanked. And then came along Ben Bernanke, who was the chairman of the Fed, and Hank Paulson, who was the Treasury Secretary. And what did they do? What was their solution to all of this?
Well, their solution, from what I understand, was to drop interest rates and flood the market with additional funds to make credit cheaper. And bottom line is that that's what caused the problem. And the market did not, they removed the market forces from that. And so in my opinion, when something like this happens, you need to allow the market to dictate what interest rate should be. Here's the fact of the matter. At that point, to loan money out on a purchase was a huge risk. Would you not agree?
I agree.
A huge risk.
Yeah.
Because the market is falling.
Yeah.
So you have to take that period of time and loan at a higher amount, knowing that the market's going to fall. Ben Bernanke's idea was lower the interest rates to make it more attractive to banks to loan money at that higher amount, knowing that the market forces are going to drop the prices of property. There was tons of vacant property available. And those people that loan the money at that super low interest rate are going to lose it again, because those people buying in, all of a sudden, if their house is worth $100,000 less, a lot of them are just going to let it go back to the bank. Realistically, that should have been the highest point of interest because of the risk versus reward. There's huge amount of risk, and then they took away any kind of reward. So what you had was, again, poor lending decisions, additional poor lending decisions piling on for the first 18 months of the crash. So I know you disagree with this, But in my opinion, what you do is you decouple that and say, let the market decide what they're going to do for new mortgage rates. What that would have done, it would have crashed the market. Instead of it lasting for 10 years, it would have crashed in a year. And you have a baseline where it's going to be, and you can build from there. Because then everything is based on risk and reward. Okay, because an investor can look at it and say, you know what, I'll lend this money at 11%. If it goes down by 2/3, I'll have the house and I'll be able to at least rent it out or use something with that. If the values come down, which they ended up doing, they ended up coming down even further than would have happened if you had done that. But they had in their mind what they were going to do. The problem is that Ben Bernanke, well, it started with Alan Greenspan, who has zero real estate experience. Ben Bernanke, zero real estate experience. Who is the guy of the head of the Paulson?
Hank Paulson.
Hank Paulson, zero real estate experience. President Bush, zero real estate experience. Well, maybe had a little bit with wildcatting for oil wells, but zero real estate experience. Who did they have that knew real estate in that? They didn't ask professors in real estate really for their idea and follow their advice. No, they went and went to people who worked in Wall Street, right? That's what they did. They had no idea about the real estate market, which is different.
Did RPAC not have a seat at the table in any of this?
RPAC, what, the realtor thing?
Yeah.
Oh, they're a bunch of fools. They're bought and sold by, no, believe me, they're bought and sold by Silicon Valley. They're looking for I do not like the Association of Realtors personally. I'm a member. I have to be part of my board, but I have very little respect for what they do. They have consistently hurt realtors with their policies, in my opinion. But that's another story. Now, they could have easily changed the whole dynamic of the crash. In 99% of all mortgages, there is a clause in there that is a due on sale clause. Are you familiar with that?
You've explained it to me, but let's explain it to the listeners.
Okay. A due on sale clause is that when you sell a property, the whole entire balance of the mortgage is due. Okay. Now, back 30 years ago, VA and FHA had something called a non-qualifying assumable, which you didn't have to qualify to assume. A new purchaser could come in and just assume the mortgage. And the buyer and seller would agree to the terms that that mortgage would be assumed. Now, the person who originated the loan, it would still be on their credit. But the new purchaser would have the ability to make those payments for the person that they bought it from. So let's use this for example. You have a house that you bought for $100,000. Your mortgage is $100,000, 100%. You go ahead and you come into this hard time because of the crash and you lose your job. You go ahead and put on, you market your property where you have a non-qualifying assumable, and somebody else can come in, give you $1,000, assume your mortgage, and start living there. Okay?
Okay.
That could not happen during the crash, because what happened was is that somebody would come in, and with $100,000 or whatever, they would have to go ahead and get a new mortgage. So they didn't have any incentive to buy your property or any property. They could just go ahead and do whatever. The thing of it is that the market would have taken care of those types of properties very quickly.
So let's talk about the benefit here. The benefit in this situation, I've fallen on hard times and can't afford my mortgage anymore, and I want you to assume the mortgage. The benefit here for me is that I don't have a foreclosure on my record.
Yes.
And the benefit for you is that you don't have to, one, make as big a down payment. You give me $1,000 and hit the road. And your let's say, 8 years into a 30-year mortgage, so you only have that 22 left.
Yes.
And you wouldn't have that same benefit if you were just trying to buy my home traditionally from me, because you would have to.
So let's say that you were an investor and you said, you know what, I really love that house down the block, and I can go ahead and take that over for $1,000 because the people are on hard times, and I really love that house. I can make the payment. I can do all those things, and then I'll just rent my house where it is now. Yeah. Buying a second house, you need a lot more money down. The qualifications is a lot harder. So that takes care of that level of market is gone. Now, what you could do is you could go ahead and move into that house and then rent your house. Maybe you have positive cash flow. Maybe you cost you an extra $100. But remember, interest rates were very low at that point. So that would make a lot of sense. So you have that whole thing. The other thing is people moving into an area, maybe you're you started your own business 18 months ago and it's doing quite well. You still need to have 2 years of tax returns in order to go ahead and buy that property. If you have a due on sale clause, you can just find somebody who's in hard times instead of going through a short sale or something along those lines. And maybe they kick in $150 a month toward the payment and you do a wraparound, like those kind of things. There's so many different financing techniques, and they took that all out of the market. The other thing they did was they now, made it.
Can we back up? And I'm sorry, okay, while you're on a road here, but you said they took that out. This was something that after the crash they insisted upon in these mortgages, or these were required in mortgages to
the
be
due on sale clause?
The due on sale clause.
The due on sale clause.
Or is that just market standard?
That is market standard that probably started about 30 years ago, because banks realized when you had a non-qualifying assumable, two things were happening. Number one is they didn't know who was making the payment. Okay, that's a legitimate issue.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing was that if you used a non-qualifying assumable and you did something called a wraparound, where this is a wraparound, you owe $28,000 left on your mortgage. And you decide you're going to sell your house for $100,000. You can owner finance your house. You go ahead and collect the payment, and then you pay the bank. Or you can set it up where the new buyer pays the bank and you have record of it. There's a lot of things you can do. You can get a third party to collect the money and make that payment. But the profit would go to the old homeowner for the difference of the interest. Banks realized that there is a lot of money to be made in origination of mortgages. There's an origination fees that they make, and there's discount points, and there's other bank fees, right? They also get a chance to have some kind of inspection by the appraiser to know what kind of property they're loaning on. They wanted to have all that intact. And when you go ahead and have the gold, you make the rules. So they went ahead and started putting those into their mortgages. And so the due on sale clause came and became an industry standard. The other thing they did is that through all of that, they made it tougher for individuals to do private financing. What a private financing would be is, let's say that I'm worth $10 million and I'm 70 years of age, and I just want to have places that I could that I can invest money in too, instead of the stock market. Well, I might go and say, oh, Mr. and Mrs. Wojciechowski, you have $100,000 down and you're buying a $300,000 home. I'll loan you the $200,000. Instead of you paying the bank, you loan it to me. They've made that very, very difficult. You can do it from time to time, but you can't really make it your business anymore. They say that that's some kind of financial issue or something like that.
So, and so these are all very good points, but I want to tie it back to the housing crisis, because you can point to this as an issue that happened, but what's the solution here? Does the Federal Reserve lean on the banks to eliminate the due on sale clause during the time? Should there have been some sketchy executive order through the Department of the Treasury saying that we're not going to prosecute violating this part of the contract anymore? Should they have you know, the Federal Reserve has power to regulate banks. Should that have been part of the thing? Like, you're not allowed to bring these to court anymore. What's this, or is this something that moving forward we should eliminate that as a requirement in mortgages? What's the policy proposal? Well,
if they would have suspended those due on sale clauses, remember
who's the
banking regulators. Remember, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac really were the main originators of these mortgage, or the main.
They purchased
entities
the
of these mortgages. And if they would have gone ahead and suspended that due on sale clause, it would have opened up the market to a lot of additional purchasers. Investors could have gone ahead and taken and worked through these deals totally different. They would have had normally investors are market experts for their own county or city or neighborhood. You know, investors know what's going on in their area better than some dude sitting in a desk in Atlanta. If you're in, you know, Birmingham, Alabama, or, you know, Knoxville, Tennessee, or a little town in Vermont. The investors of those areas know that market so much better. The other thing is that you asked me about those sketchy things. Is it any more sketchy than the federal government giving money, picking winners and losers in the solar industry?
Oh, certainly not.
Or giving money to General Motors to stay going? I mean, you know, do I think General Motors need to be to continue on as a viable corporation? Sure. But AIG, they spent billions on AIG, but they didn't lift a finger to just make that small change, which would have cost nothing and saved the taxpayers hundreds of billions.
I'm certainly not here defending any of the bailouts for General Motors or AIG or anything like that. I'm just wondering what the policy proposal is here.
They also restricted the market from correcting itself by doing what they did. They had a bunch of top-down policy approaches.
Doing what they did when you say specifically the easy money, lowering the interest rates.
Well, lowering the interest rates, making it ridiculous, taking away the ability for private investors to loan money. They shut down the market. And you can say, well, it was they didn't know what else to do. Well, okay, so you're saying that they didn't know what else to do. So if that is your argument, you're saying I am ignorant, right? I don't know what else to do. So that means you're ignorant on how to fix the problem. But they didn't go to the people who understood the problem the best, which is the local people in those markets. They didn't want to deal with that. They wanted to deal with their position. And I understand if you're Alan Greenspan, you don't want to admit you're wrong. Did you hear how he actually kind of, and I'm paraphrasing here, he said our model had a couple of flaws in it. Well, really?
I tell people this all the time. The one thing that I learned in grad school is that those models are just absolutely, they never work.
Well, you know, I have a model that I'm going to go ahead and run my home electric with a small nuclear power plant. I have a few flaws in that model. I don't know how to build a small nuclear power plant to run my house. Is that a flaw in my model? Or is that just being, I'm stupid, right? I don't know. I don't know where that goes, where I have a flaw in my model. Bottom line is, you're the Federal Reserve Chairman. Right. And this is Alan Greenspan's puppy.
Right.
Right. You're the Federal Reserve Chairman. And your excuse is I had a flaw in my model. No, you didn't ask the people who should have known better. In fact, there was tons of people who told you. You just didn't want it. You didn't want to hear it. And Ben Bernanke, I think he was a victim of his situation? Do I think he did things right? No, he wouldn't correct the things that could be corrected. But, you know, that's just me.
He's a Nobel Prize winner now. Can I push back on you?
Sure.
Pushing back on my dad here.
All right.
Woo!
This is what I raised him to do.
You got your real estate license in when you were 18. So you've had it for roughly 89 years now.
Yeah.
And this is, you have the incentive to do this because real estate is your field, but every single thing you said, it's been about real estate, about real estate, and about real estate. And you have very good reason to do this. It was what kicked the housing crash was what kicked off the Great Recession in the first place. You deal almost exclusively in real estate, which is your business, and you're very good at it, blah, 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 all that crap. But they were dealing with an economy here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
you have agriculture, which you can make parallels. It's analogous to real estate in a lot of ways, but you got tech, you got, the food industry, you got, automobile industry. You have a lot more American industry. The American economy is the most complex in the world. So your issue with lowering the interest rates when the recession came was all because of what it would do to the real estate market. But you're perhaps not seeing the entire forest of the American economy because you're focusing on the one tree of real estate. So you would have had a lot more issues with the supply chain if you didn't lower the interest rate, because all of those supply chain issues deal with like borrowing money real quick from these banks and things like that. In conventional wisdom, because Milton Friedman, as he said, was inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. You were dealing with the prospect of deflation, which would have really harmed these other industries. So you want to lower the interest rate to kind of pump more money back into the economy to kind of grease the gears of the American economy.
So, you know, you bring up a very, very interesting point. And you can decouple the two. There's no saying that there's many different interest rates for certain different types of industries that are there right now. There's an overnight lending rate, correct?
Correct.
Which is essentially not as high as what you can borrow for a car, correct?
Well, that's but the overnight rate is the one that the Fed has direct control over.
Right. If you let the market, if you let individual banks in areas make the decision on how to loan instead of some kind of national Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac standard that basically bullies everybody, you're going to have that effect. Also, you took hard money lenders out of the equation, individual investors out of the equation because of that. And what I was saying is that individual investors, if you took the due on sale clause, make those rules anyway. And so they took all those rules away. So you couldn't decouple the two. It was a top-down philosophy of mortgage lending. And you have it today, right?
So
you have it today that people can't make those decisions. And so they take away risk and reward with regards to interest rates on mortgages, but you have risk reward in the stock market, you have risk reward in the tech field, you have risk reward in those other places. There's no reason why you couldn't say, look, we are going to have short-term interest rates lower than long-term interest rates. I don't see why. Or you just say that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac will only buy mortgages at higher interest rates or market interest rates. I mean, you don't have to. They set the rates.
Well, the Federal Reserve doesn't set those rates. That's department. I actually don't know the structure of Fannie and Freddie. I assume they're
I don't know the exact
sort of
structure either.
Independent agencies that are. I feel like if Bush wanted to throw his weight around, he could have changed those things. But you can't blame that on Ben Bernanke and Alan Greenspan. I mean, I think everybody likes to because like they're the chairman of the Fed. We think they're the economy person. If the economy is not going well, then we can point to them. But all of these issues with the due on sale clause and the kind of mortgages that Fannie and Freddie were buying are outside of the control of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve has relatively little controls at their disposal, right?
I think if the Federal Reserve would come out and say, you know, one of the biggest issues that we have is a due on sale clause. If that was removed, it would really stabilize the mortgage market. I think that would put a huge amount of pressure on Fannie and Freddie to say, look, we're going to suspend those for the next 36 months.
But the Federal Reserve has made it a policy to stick in its lane. You watch any time Jay Powell was just talking to the Senate Finance Committee, I guess it was a couple months ago now, and they kept asking him, what should be done here? What should be done here? What should be done here? And he answered it the same way that all Federal Reserve chairmen and chairwoman have answered that question. They say, I have my specific areas here that I am going to focus on. And we're not going to give advice on other sectors of the economy. We're going to play the cards we are given.
And well, I think that there's not what happened with prior to the crash. Alan Greenspan did not stay in his lane then.
What did Alan Greenspan do?
Well, they were happy with the way the mortgage, they said nothing about it.
That's what I'm saying.
They should have raised interest rates as the market got overheated, but they didn't. They kept them low. So they did not stay in their lane. They should look at the economy and make forward – nothing forward. There was nothing forward.
So you think it should be more they should make more decisions pre – as opposed to just a post, they should make more pre-hoc decisions instead of just being.
I don't know what pre-hoc means. Well, awfully.
Oh, stop.
Awfully Latin. But
oh,
yes.
Stop. Yeah, make me look like the douchebag here. That's too Latin.
That's too Latin.
Pre-hoc means. Crying out loud. You think they should be less reactionary? Is that a small enough word for you?
They're. Yes, I think they should be less reactionary and look at really what's happening forward looking. And that's what they supposedly are doing, right? Isn't that why they meet? Not, oh, wow, this is going on. Let's react to it. I think that they should be, you know, they really run a lot of how the country runs. And we don't have our financial markets are very, very regulated, very regulated.
They're overregulated.
I agree
for sure.
I agree with that. I'm just saying if they would have allowed market forces to happen, the crash would have happened. Okay. The crash would have happened. No doubt about it. The crash would have happened, but the values would have dropped much faster and a base would have formed much, much faster. The damage would be quite a bit limited because it happened all much faster and you could build off that base quicker. To be honest with you, I mean, like anything, I mean, a quote from Gone with the Wind is, you know, there's as much money to be made in the tearing down of a country as there is of building it up. And a lot of people made, that's not a direct quote, obviously, but I can't remember it, but, you know, there was a lot of people who made a lot of money when the crash happened as it was happening. A lot of people didn't. A lot of people lost. But some people made tremendous amounts of money.
So let's kind of talk about the aftermath of this all. There was a lot of new regulation put in place, which my personal opinion is that most of it's crap. But now we're kind of in a real estate high. It seems to be settling a little bit, but it doesn't. I don't think there's really a crash going on. It's the highest it's been since then, especially in Florida. But all across the country, it seems real estate values are up, especially rents. Do you see when this comes down? Do you think it comes to a crashing halt, the same way it did in 2007? Is the market safer now? Have people kind of learned their lesson, or did they kind of missed the plot entirely? And are we in a pretty precarious situation.
Well, you know, the thing about with real estate is it's all to the individual living in a home. Because each family unit is their own little micro economy, correct?
Correct.
That's the microest of the micro economies, right?
Yeah.
So some families are doing great. If you're a person who is a household with two people working in healthcare in a growing area of the country, like Texas or Florida, your income is moving up. Real estate prices have come down. You can go ahead and do well, right? When interest rates come down. Interest rates have been hiked up, and it's really slowed down purchases. I think the demand is still there. I think people still want to move. I mean, I don't know if people want to move to Buffalo right this week, since they have like 7 feet of snow on the ground or 25 feet of snow on the ground. I don't know how much snow they have, but a ton. And they probably, you know, it's probably tougher to sell a property in Buffalo today than it was 3 months ago because of that. But I think that if you're in a growing area and you have a good job, there's a lot of fundamentals that as far as values crashing in real estate, I just don't see it happening. I could be wrong. And I have been wrong. My crystal ball's broken. But I don't see that. If interest rates moderate where they don't go up and start trending down, which I think they will, I don't see huge drops in values. The main reason is because we've had so much inflation, unless we have huge amounts of deflation in the construction materials area, it just costs so much to build stuff. And that is your floor. That is the floor that really sets in for values. Because if there's more units needed in an area, you got to build them.
Yeah.
And so that kind of keeps a floor underneath your market. Now, if you're in a declining market where you're declining population, and I think there's some areas around the country, certain cities, but definitely not nationwide. Our population is growing, so housing units are needing. Not only is the population growing, but we have huge immigration going on.
Yeah.
That's going to put pressure on housing units, and our household size is getting smaller. So that puts a huge pressure pent-up demand. So I don't think the values are going to go down too terribly much because I think there's a little bit, 10, 15, 20% maybe, but not 50, 60, 70, 80%, which is some of what we saw in the crash.
Is the regulatory market better? Is it more solid?
I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I don't know if the regulatory market really hasn't changed much. I do know this, that I just closed on a deal, and the closing package paperwork for FHA was like 160 pages from that bank. And so it seems to me like there's more and more disclosures are adding. I don't even know. Some of them just made no sense. They were just additional, and we understand that.
Well,
it becomes more and more complicated every year. The other thing that I think is going to keep real estate values from dropping too much is it's tougher to develop. We continue to have more and more environmental regulations that are necessary. The cost of engineering, the complexity of plans has gone up. And if you go to areas like California, it's even far more expensive and more complex to build there than here in Florida. Now, you go to a place like West Virginia, they have relatively zero requirements in comparison, but, you know, that's not a super growing area. But.
Right. Actually, I think their population hiked up quite a bit during COVID.
Really?
Yeah, because everybody, well, they were given $2,000 to everybody that would move to West Virginia to work remote. And a lot of people took them up on that because real estate was cheap and the mountains are pretty. And if you can work your job in the pretty mountains, it's better than being in a city where you can do nothing.
I agree. So, I agree. You know, we're down here in Florida, and we had a little bit of COVID disruptions, but I think we bounced back faster than anybody else.
Y'all bounced back quick. Yeah.
Real estate's a lot of fun. I enjoy it. You know, I have, you kid about me all the time about this is what I talk about all the time. So let me ask you a question.
Let's hear it.
What do you think they did wrong during the crash?
What they do? So my whole issue is pre-crash, right? I think anytime you interject in the market and say, and I think anytime you have an elected official, you have the president come up in front of everybody and say, this thing is part of the American dream and we need to push it. You have issues, right? So you're seeing this with the cost of education right now. There's been a big push from people in high place of power saying, and it's not just political elites, it's cultural elites saying, everybody needs to go to college. We're going to shove people into colleges and we're going to make them borrow money, and the price of tuition has gone up. And I think the same thing happened with the financial crisis, was that you have the president saying, we think that it's part of the American dream to own a home. We need everybody to own a home. So you've put incentives in place to make these really, really bad loans. And when you have that incentive structure in place, you've really set yourself up to fail. So you've forced through a lot of bad loans. The day of reckoning on that was going to come. And then from there, you're playing catch up. And I think when you're playing catch up, it's hard to fault people too terribly bad for the way that they look around to kind of pull up their drawers when they've been lost in the sea. So yeah, I think probably if I was chairman of the Fed, the first thing I would have done was lower interest rates, because that's kind of what you do in a recession. That's conventional wisdom. I think it was a bad idea to bail out Bear Stearns, or they didn't bail out Bear Stearns, AIG and
Bank of America
and
not Bank of America. No, it was Countrywide.
Countrywide. I think Hank Paulson kind of went to Bank of America and said, you're buying Merrill Lynch and that's that. They kind of got, if you read Ben Bernanke, talked about this in his book, how he and Hank Paulson kind of brought them into an office and said, look, this is what you're going to do. So I think anytime that you put the government hand in the private market, there's going to be all these bad things to come of it. And I think that, you know, that those are things that really slowed down the recovery. But honestly, I think you don't make these big declarations about what is part of the American dream. Because I think the American dream is what every individual wants that American dream to be. And you set yourself up for failure when you force these things upon people and upon the economy. And I think that's what happened.
You know, it's very interesting you said about everybody's, you know, the American dream is what everybody wants it to be. Last night we were here camping in very, very cold weather, right?
Right.
And we're on the banks of Lake Seminole, and our space heater broke. So we're freezing inside of our pop-up, correct?
Correct.
And we did have electric blankets. But what did we wake up to? What was the sound that woke you up at some point?
The gunshots?
Yeah. People duck hunting here on Lake Seminole. I didn't know they were going to be duck hunting at, 6 a.m.?
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, we start hearing that. That's their American dream, right?
Right.
They want to come out, get in their little duck boat at 5:30, go out to on a frozen lake in 28 degrees, you know, ride their boat along. So wind chill when you're going 20 miles an hour, 28 degrees is like -4 or something horrible like that, to go shoot a duck. I ain't doing that. It was cold enough in my pop-up, you know, and it was not frozen inside there. But that's their idea of an American dream. And you're exactly right on that, right?
Yeah.
They wanted to do that. And I think you're right. And my whole thing when I talked about the due on sale clause, and I'd like your opinion on that as well, is that it just took away so many options for people to salvage their credit, salvage their livelihood, salvage their dignity, salvage the fact that there's not a foreclosure on their permanent record. I think you took it away that away from a lot of people.
So here's my opinion on the due on sale clause thing. I agree with you that it took away the ability to salvage a lot of things. But it's also an agreement that private individuals made amongst themselves. It was a contract that both parties signed. And theoretically, everybody that signed those contracts was qualified enough to A, understand the contract, or B, hire an attorney to understand what exactly they were getting into. And that's why I don't know enough about the origination of the due on sale clause. Like if that was something that Fannie and Freddie required in a mortgage in order to purchase it, then
it is required.
If that is required, then in that case, it was a stupid decision again in the first place. But I have issues with setting a precedent of a government being able to step in and say, we are going to declare right here, right now, that this portion of these private contracts that were made are now null and void. And most of the time, if I understand it correctly, Fannie and Freddie didn't really hang on to these mortgages. They purchased these mortgages from these mortgage originators, cut them up into tranches, and sold them to private individuals, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I have an issue with government agencies saying that these portions of these contracts are void now.
The one thing I will throw out to you is that if you are – part of the American dream is that you would be able to own your own home at some point. I mean, a traditional – like if you look back, what is part – if you were to say what is the American dream that most people are – that they think of? Owning
their I'll own say I'll property. I'll hedge it this way. I think that, yes, most people want to own a home.
Okay. So if you want to own a home – a majority of the people will have to get a mortgage, correct?
Correct.
The money just doesn't float out of the sky.
Yeah.
You get a mortgage, you have no negotiating power, nothing you can bring to the table as a normal homeowner unless you're mega wealthy. You have zero say what's in your mortgage. The bank says, this is the mortgage, you take it. Because Fannie Mae says this is what it's going to say, you have zero chance to change that.
But again, this is what Fannie has said. This right. is what Fannie and Freddie have said. They're government agencies saying this. I think there was far too much regulation in place, that's not even a regulatory thing, because you had it set up to where these agencies were stepping in and artificially making the cost of borrowing lower.
Okay, so you said that you are against the federal government giving these, saying that we're gonna go into a private agreement and make those changes.
Yeah.
But they did it on the other side for benefit of the banks. Wholesale for banks, for AIG, for investors. They went ahead and bailed out all of the big boys. All of them. So that's fine. If you said we're going to let it all fall, let them all fall and let private investors pick up all the pieces. But what they did was they said, you know what? We pick you to be a winner. We're going to give you all this stuff. We're going to say that, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, who somehow they're the first homeowner in five generations in their family bought a home, we're going to let them go out, but we're going to save this huge financial institution who, by the way, is just a financial institution. There's another financial institution that will buy those assets out immediately somewhere at some price. But they said the little guy fails, the big guy doesn't.
So you're acting like... You're acting like I'm taking the government's side and all that.
No. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying is that what you said was that you were against you felt that that was wrong. I'm saying is, I feel like if you go ahead, who's got more knowledge, the little guy or the big guy?
The big guy.
Who has more assets, the little guy or the big guy?
The big guy.
Who has more chances of this really turning out to be in their favor 98% of the time?
It's always going to be the big guy. There's certainly.
So the government says, we're still going with the big guy, the big guy, the big guy, the big guy, right? It happens in criminals, right?
Yeah.
With criminals. You got the money. You can buy the attorneys. You can go ahead and do that. You have a better chance of getting away with the crime, right?
Yeah.
Rather than somebody that doesn't. And this is, again, a situation where, you know, a couple who's four generations in America, who lives in Baltimore, buys a property, right? And they scrape together their money, and now they don't have anything. They're the fall guy, not the guy on Wall Street. And I don't think that that's right. The guy in Wall Street needed to fall before the guy in Baltimore.
I don't think that's right either, because the guy in Baltimore is not the person who did anything wrong here.
No,
they went out to the real estate market and they found something that they could afford. They're not going to sit there and ask why, and they shouldn't have to. But I'm saying that on all sides,
yes,
this was wrong. And I think when you look at the root of the matter, it's because we set up a situation in which we made it artificially cheap to borrow money.
Yes.
And
here's the other thing too. If they just would have deregulated all of it right when it happened, or not had any regulation and just let interest rates fall where they may, where you have maybe for a mortgage 16%, because there's a huge amount of risk and boy, you could really lose. The investors can make their decision. I don't have a problem with that. The market crashes and you rebuild right away.
Well, you look at your economic history before the Great Depression. That's how it happened. When economies would crash, and there were recessions and depressions before the Great Depression, the economy would bottom out. Just like you said, it would bottom out and it would hit massive lows and then just immediately pop back up.
The panic of 1898, for example.
Exactly. Or the crash of the Knickerbocker trust.
Yeah.
It would crash and then immediately bounce back. And I think that's a better way to run things.
I agree. And if you did that, those people who were in those houses that were making payments, they wouldn't have gotten foreclosed on because it was so quick they could have somehow made it back.
Yeah. And probably you'd have banks that would work for you. If you were 3 months behind on mortgages, probably how long was it taking to foreclose people during the height?
Oh, the height? Two years.
2 years?
Yeah.
So I'm sure, you know, if somebody said, look, can we defer payments for 3 months? Generally, a bank would probably work with you.
Especially when they knew it was
especially if they knew it was 3 months.
And they saw the economy improving.
Yeah. And they saw the economy improving. You said, look, can we push back the end of this mortgage 3 months? I think a bank would work with you. Especially when you're dealing with the, because back then, you know, with regulation always comes the concentration of markets. So in a situation in which it's really deregulated, you probably have more borrowing from smaller credit unions and things like that.
Or individuals.
You know,
Rich Uncle Harold.
Rich Uncle Harold or, you know, Barbara from, you know, what's that credit union that you go to all the time? Campus USA? Yeah. You know, you've paid your mortgage on time every year for 10 years. Hey, I'm going through a bit of a rough patch. Can I get 3 months? Barbara's going to help you out there.
Yeah.
And
figure out a way.
You've really ruined all that when now it's just a no-name investor that, you know, it's been your mortgage has been sold 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, bottom line is that they never listen to the local market. You know, the other thing that you just brought up is about talking to Uncle Harold. Is he local or is he national?
He's local. Yeah.
And how about the credit union? Is he local? Yeah. If you let those people make those decisions, and not, you know, the head of Fannie, I'll bet you the head of Fannie Mae got his monthly paycheck every single month.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, did he lose some money in the stock market? Yeah. But did he lose his house? No, probably not.
Yeah.
You know, and did Alan Greenspan lose his retirement? I'll bet you he didn't.
No.
And so, you know, and this was orchestrated by him. And he admitted there was a flaw in my model. You know, it's really, you cannot have your fingers in everybody's living room and then come up with an excuse like that.
Yeah. But, you know, at a local level, Barbara's able to say, oh, you know what? The grocery store on Fifth Street's opening back up. You can get a job there. I trust him to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, maybe but that's not the way it works. And, you know, bottom line is that I think, and they've made it worse where there's no hard money lenders out there like there used to be and other opportunities for people to get some short-term help, because sometimes it only is 3 months, 6 months until you can get back on your feet.
Yeah.
But you know what? It worked out fine. There was some unbelievable once in a generation type opportunities in the real estate market. And sometimes you're able to some people saw that and was able to take advantage of it.
Yeah.
National companies took advantage of that.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we are approaching an hour.
Really?
Actually, we're at an hour and a minute.
Did you enjoy this?
I did enjoy this. What do you think of, how did we do in the transfer portal this year?
Oh, well, I think that.
We're both alumni of the Florida State University.
Yes. The Seminoles are a part of our family's DNA. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree.
I mean, I tell people all the time, there was two perfect places ever in this world, the Garden of Eden and the original campus of Florida State University. I think that those are the two most perfect places ever on the planet. But no, I think we did fantastic in the portal. You know, we've done it the last few years. I think Mike Norvell is doing a fantastic job as head coach there.
I don't think anybody was expecting a 9-win, potentially 10-win season.
Yeah, or I guess we're going to know when. Tomorrow. Is today Wednesday?
Today's Wednesday.
Yeah. So tomorrow we'll know if we're by the end of the day in 32 hours, 34 hours, we will know if we have our first 10-win season in a long time.
In a long time. You and Mom going to go to that game? I know you had looked at it.
We might. We have not made the decision, but I know that you
me and PJ will be there.
Yeah.
It'll be so a good
time. Two Culvers will be there with their eyes on the ball.
I'm excited. I haven't been to an FSU game in like 3
You're
going to
watch
years.
The center position?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Obviously. That,
gotcha.
Really, I mean, I say a couple of things. One, you know, the only important position on the football field is the center. Everybody else kind of just plays around him. And the other thing I say is that, you know, antitrust is really the bedrock of the legal system, and everything else just kind of plays around that, I think.
Well, I'll agree. You know, I will have to agree with that. And that's what we were talking about in a lot of ways was antitrust issues, were we not?
Well, perhaps. I guess people with a large hand or share in the market, I suppose. But I don't think anybody would take me seriously. Nobody takes me seriously when I say that.
I will say this. I almost think that Florida State is closely getting a monopoly on the best players in the portal.
On the best players in the transfer portal?
Yeah.
I hope so. We've done really well. We need to do better in high school recruiting. We need a field goal kicker.
That's true. We do need to do better in high school recruiting and a field goal kicker. But, you know, I think we're going to have one of the best quarterbacks in the country next year. And we have one now. I think our receivers look good. Our running backs look good. Our offensive line should be good. Our defensive line should be good. I'm a little bit concerned with our defensive secondary. And our linebackers may be a little thin to make a championship run. But I think we're much, much better than we were.
And the idea that we're even talking in those terms
is insane.
Is insane. Yeah. Last year we lost to Jackson State.
Yeah. And this year we're saying, you know, next year we could compete for the ACC title.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, this year we actually could have. We had, and that's where depth hurt us.
Yeah.
We didn't have enough depth.
Yeah.
So, you know, really the economy is semi-important, but Florida State football is really the most important thing.
Yeah. I don't care who's in the White House, as long as FSU is having a good run too.
Yeah.
Politics is secondary.
Yep. I agree with that. That is important. And, I don't know what's going on in the pros. Don't know. I hope, Roger Staubach and Bart Starr having good seasons this year. I don't know anything about what's going on there. Bart Hockey. Starr. And of course, people following the World Cup or the Nations Cup or whatever.
Well, the World Cup, I think, just finished up. I think Morocco won.
Who?
Morocco. It's a country.
Yeah, I know that, but I don't know. I can't understand. What is offsides in soccer? I still haven't figured that out.
I don't really know.
What is that? Offside? Like, okay.
Well, anything else you want to let my listener know before we call it a day?
Yeah. I will tell you this much. America is the best place in the world to live. It is the most outstanding. It's a lot of fun to live in this period of time. And I really am very, very, if I was to invest, I would invest in America's future, because our best run is still to come.
Oh, I love that.
I think it is.
I think so too.
I mean, I think, and one other thing, America's youth is the best youth we've ever had. In my opinion, they're smarter, they're quicker. They have more knowledge. They can easily get it. Don't let the liberal media think that we are falling behind, because we are the best country and we have the best people and we have the best citizenry in the world.
PH Colvert, Dad, thank you for coming on the show.
It was a blast. And is this your first location spot, right?
I think so. I haven't.
So this is the best view of any location.
I have not yet had such a great, awesome view in doing this podcast. And I hope that the view kind of comes through in the quality of this episode.
I think maybe if you turn it up, you can hear some of the waterfowl chirping.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Waterfowl.
Because, I mean, there's ducks and other stuff.
Dad the botanist.
We're talking about birds.
Wait, no, that's right. What is ornithology? Plants, crap.
Are you going to put that needs to stay in there?
That's going
to
stay. And this little conversation about staying is going to stay. I don't edit my podcast.
Well, that's great.
All right.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, Court. And maybe we'll do a part two on something else and you pick the subject.
That sounds good. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks.